Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our host will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our host will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello and welcome to Republic Forces Radio Network, where we discuss all things Clone Wars. Tonight, we're talking Season 5, Episode 15, Shades of Reason. And joining me tonight is Barrett.
Hey everybody, it's Barrett, Master Collect 'em All from the forums, your Swan Holocron Enhancer, and I am so excited to be on this podcast right now that no words could express. I'm just glad to be here, Jonathan.
Nathan P. Butler.
Hey y'all, Jonathan, you know I'm really just the one ruling things. You're a figurehead.
We may have a challenge on our hands then. And Jerry.
Don't worry, people of Republic Forces. I will eradicate the evil here and bring Republic Forces back to its warrior ways.
So yes, we have a lot to talk about tonight. This is the third episode in this four-part arc that deals with our Knight Brothers, the Mandalorians, Death Watch, and what have you. I know I love this episode, but what did you guys think? We'll start with Barrett.
What an episode. I don't think that anyone could find anything too wrong with this episode. I mean, we had everything. Amazing battles. We had a great plan on how to control a populace, and it was just great. I'm really excited to hear what everybody else thinks about the episode, to see if me and Nathan can find anything we can disagree about this episode. I don't think we will.
Nathan, what did you think?
Well, you know, I have to disagree with Barrett, you know, just for the sake of the fact that we haven't disagreed in a while. No, I agree. I mean, this was a very good episode. I think if there's anything that holds the episode back, it's only the fact that they had to cram so much into one episode. It's actually something Dave Filoni even talks about in the featurette this week about how they had so much to do and so little time in which to do it, especially since basically the final battle had to be sort of an act unto itself. Excellent episode, great payoff, not just for last week, but also for stuff that we saw back in previous seasons with Death Watch, with the removal of Almec all the way back. I'm hoping this means that they really had this planned out far enough in advance that as they headed onward, they were already laying the seeds. That it's not just a, hey, look, that's a cool thing we left behind there and never dealt with. Let's deal with it now. It really shows the strength of this series when you've got a few seasons of previous work behind you to be able to pull these threads together. Great episode.
And Jerry.
Last week's episode was really, really cool. And this one just ratcheted up another level. According to Dave Filoni, we ain't seen nothing yet. I just was in awe of this episode. I really was. Just the intricacy of the plot, the, you know, really seeing things come together for Pre Vizsla's story and just the role Darth Maul played in it. And just how relevant it seems to the themes that this series has been building on over the last, yeah, I guess since season two when they brought Mandalorians into it. Can't wait to see where it goes from here.
And as I said, I really loved this episode. I think if I had to pick anything to criticize about it, it's this brought so much into it. I have no idea how they're going to wrap it up next episode to finish this arc. There's so many things going on that they could tie it up in a neat bow, but this thing, I can't wait to watch all four episodes in a row. In starting this episode, we jump into the action in a planning meeting between Death Watch, the Knight Brothers, Black Sun, and the Syndicate, and they discuss how they're going to stage the takeover of Mandalore. Maul has the plan that the crime lords and his, as he puts it, his crime army will attack Mandalore and show Duchess Satine's weakness in protecting the populace. And then Death Watch will come in and be seen as the conquering heroes by defending the populace. Now, this is a pretty good plan, considering. What do you guys think?
My only thing with it is, it kind of plays out in the episode a little bit, is it just seems a little too convenient. Hey, we're being overrun by these crime lords. Don't know why they're here. Don't know why they're choosing now. And oh, hey, Death Watch just happens to show up to save us. and the other crime syndicate there for like 4 years or 9 months or something before Death Watch shows up. So I appreciate why they had to do it. At the very least, they had a little bit of this plan that, hey, we're going to come in as the saviors, and that's going to convince everybody to go back to their warrior way. So I liked how they're approaching it, but for the sake of a single 22-minute episode, it did seem a little convenient.
I was thinking about this during the episode, during the multiple times I watched this. When the syndicates come in, when Black Sun and the Spice Dealers and the Knight Brothers come in and start roughing things up, and then all of a sudden Death Watch is there, two things occurred to me. One, I think, I don't know why I got the impression that Death Watch at least always had some presence on Mandalore, whether it was openly or secretly, but they've always been there. And two, that period of time when they're taking over the docks and terrorizing the populace, I almost viewed that as like a montage where it happened over a longer period of time than it appeared to in that episode. And that kind of let me come to grips with your issues, Jerry, about the convenience of it. Nathan, Barrett, what'd you guys think?
It felt somewhat convenient to me in terms of, you know, here comes the Death Watch to save the day right at the right moment. But you gotta figure they've been around. They probably had some elements there, although we did see them previously on another planet back in A Friend in Need. Kind of one of those things where it's political opportunism. I mean, of course they're going to come in and try to save things. I mean, what was it that Rahm Emanuel said? Never let a good crisis go to waste. I mean, that's essentially what the Death Watch could be seen as doing here. So yeah, it's convenient, but it could just be, see, now they picked the time to come in here. They're just taking advantage of the situation as opposed to it having to be a matter of convenience there. Part of it I also thought was maybe the fact that, yes, it seems like they show up pretty quickly and they deal with the problems pretty quickly, but at the same time, if they hadn't done so quite as quickly, wouldn't there have been the possibility of, say, Satine calling in the Jedi or something, and that could perhaps have disrupted their plans? So they had to somewhat move fast before there could be another solution presented that might actually work at driving off some of Maul's people. What I was surprised by, or I guess I shouldn't have been surprised by, but I think most fans would have been surprised by, and it kind of took me aback for a moment, was the way they're presenting Maul, again, as we saw last episode, as sort of this strategist. Yeah, we initially get this idea of Maul as just sort of the battering ram back in the Phantom Menace. We've gotten the books lately. You get the short stories, The Wrath of Darth Maul, the Darth Plagueis novel that gives us a sense of sort of what they wanted of Maul, given when Sidious and when Plagueis were both around at the same time, while Maul was around, etc., etc. You get the sense that there's a lot more to this character, a lot more planning to this character than we usually gave him credit for. And I think this finally is really bearing that out here. And Sam Witwer does a great job of portraying him in the different mindsets in this episode. I mean, he's got the thoughtful strategist angle. He's got the not really subdued, but sort of the, yes, brother, chill out. We'll get to that point, but relax. We're at this point of the plan now, kind of calmness. And then, of course, at the end, we've got sort of the big, boisterous, fiery nature of Maul. I'd say it's probably his best performance as Maul that we've seen since Fighter Maul, and he was sort of babbling through the Sith code and whatnot, and giving us that impression of him being flat out of his mind. But it's not something, I don't think anybody watching The Phantom Menace would have guessed that this is where Maul would have ended up from the standpoint of characterization, that he'd be the thoughtful one. But it worked out great, albeit a little fast.
Well, I think it worked out great. It makes sense for me for Maul to be a strategist and to think about the big picture, whether Sidious was grooming Maul just so he could sacrifice himself someday. He wasn't going to groom him as an apprentice that would succeed him. Maul learned anyway. And it makes sense to me that he would be this strategist. And it was his best performance as Maul. And what they're doing too, again, is they're really separating who Maul is and who Savage is. And I really appreciate that. You know, I want to be able to recognize Savage for who he is and Maul for who he is. And I can accept this version of Maul. This is my Maul.
But the other thing we see is that Savage is starting to learn from Maul. Savage is starting to think. At the beginning, he identifies that he believes Vizsla is going to betray them. Then they discuss the fact that they can find a new co-conspirator on Mandalore. And Savage goes, well, greed will bring him to us. He's learning from Maul. Maul is, besides everything else he's been, strategist, warrior, what have you, he is a good master as far as Sith goes.
And Savage, of course, had to be brought to that point, not just in terms of learning. Remember, this arc doesn't just start last week. It starts with Revival, that thankfully is going to be shoved back into the right chronological order from what I understand. And what do we get in an early point of Revival? We get Maul essentially putting Savage in his place and saying, you know, it's not about brothers right now. I'm the master. You're the apprentice. That's the way the Sith work. You are going to learn from me. And in Revival, we didn't really see that much. We had a little of that last week, but now we're really seeing it start to flourish for Savage. I think it's another reason why putting Revival so much earlier in the season in the airing order didn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense, because I think it's a necessary component to what we're seeing in Savage's character development here based on what happened in Revival.
Well, we see the assault on Mandalore. The fact that these people really have no way of defending themselves. They're a pacifist people, much as we see Alderaan becoming in the original trilogy. No major weapons, no way of defending themselves. And Nathan, something you said earlier about them not being able to call in the Jedi or not having time to call in the Jedi, could they? They're not allied with the Republic. This was something that was brought up a little later in the episode, and it kind of made me go, oh yeah, this is a neutral system. The Republic has no rights to it and has no, I guess, pledge to protect them. Besides Obi-Wan's relationship with Satine, there's no real connection there, is there?
Yes and no, because, yeah, they are a neutral system. Therefore, in theory, they can't rely on the Jedi for help. But constantly, the Jedi and the Republic have shown they want influence on Mandalore. They want influence through Satine into those other neutral worlds. So it would have made sense that just like they could have called on Obi-Wan earlier in a couple of different arcs, just like we've got the issue of Ahsoka going there to train the next generation of leaders at one point. That's what Maul is counting on, right? Maul and Vizsla are counting on Obi-Wan showing up. So at some point, it makes logical sense they're going to call on the Jedi. If they had waited longer, I got a feeling they could have called them in earlier just from a logistical standpoint, and that maybe didn't fit Maul's timetable. Maybe this plays into his whole master strategy. Or maybe they just needed to cram it into 22 minutes.
After Mandalore's been terrorized by Black Sun and the other syndicates, Death Watch comes in, makes a grand entrance, and Satine blames them right away. Oh, you've got to be behind this. Vizsla plays his part well, going, no, but I understand what we need to do and what we need to bring to make Mandalore safe. And they have a lot of very interestingly staged conflicts between the crime syndicates and Death Watch. The only thing I will say at this point, if they want to come in and be the saviors, I'm thinking maybe they should have changed their name. Death Watch, that doesn't exactly instill good feelings.
Well, the Guardian Angels were taken, so I don't know.
We were saved by the Throat Cutters! You know, the one thing I did like about these scenes where the syndicate and the gangsters were attacking and robbing the vaults and stuff like that were the police officers, the Mandalore police officers, were kind of taking the place as clones. They were kind of nameless figures. They all kind of looked the same, and they were just getting blown up left and right and shot, but they were brave. You know, there was none of them, whenever they spoke, talking about running away, they still had that Mandalore, whatever Mandalorians have, that warrior spirit. Even though they're pacifists, those guys ran towards the danger, you know, and they were fodder. I mean, they were just getting taken out left and right. There was nothing they can do, but they were still brave. I like that they kept that spirit going with the Mandalores that were still the pacifists.
And it wasn't only the guards getting taken out. They were blowing away civilians. And I was surprised to see that in this show, but it fits with what they were trying to do.
Well, you know, it kind of fits this whole idea. You know, he said they're acting kind of like clones. I mean, they did use the same character models over and over again, just like on Onderon. So now we've got, you know, most Mandalorian women apparently look the same. Most Mandalorian men apparently look the same. What cracked me up of those sequences, on one, you got, is it Zitun Moj, I think is his name? The guy that was the new head of Black Sun since the last one lost his head last episode, or at least of this faction of Black Sun. They get to a point where the Death Watch shows up, and he just throws down his weapon and holds up his hands. In my mind, I'm thinking, my give up. And then you've got the fact that it's Bo-Katan, who we wind up finding at the end as sort of the more honorable, more for her people, not for her faction type person, who's the one who goes to help the children, for instance. I think that played out well. It just has a few of those little, you know, blink and you'll miss it kind of funny moments in there that I'm not sure they meant.
So Death Watch stages its rescues, and there's a great scene where Vizsla and Savage are dueling, and Vizsla overpowers, big air quotes there. We get an interesting callback to an earlier season when Satine is imprisoned and she begins speaking with Almec. hey, we haven't seen him in a while.
Corruption. From that episode, corruption, they said like 900 times. And Satine's talking to Amick for like 4 seconds and says, you're behind the corruption. Just couldn't help but to chuckle on that.
I gotta ask, Jonathan, though, it's not that he goes in, well, I mean, they go in there and they imprison Satine, but that's not the way it's presented to the people. It's not like they're going along with the idea that she's being locked up. It sounded to me, at least the way that it's presented to the people, that she essentially has run away, that they haven't bothered to protect, so they have kind of cut and run. And then later on, whenever she winds up, you know, supposedly being the one to kill Vizsla, we have Almec talking about how, you know, she was behind that assassination, so she has now been arrested for it. I never got the sense in the early part when she's first locked up that the populace knew what the heck was going on with that. I don't think they knew she had been arrested. At least it certainly didn't seem like that from the way that the character dialogue played out.
No, the populace had no idea that she had been arrested. It was very secretive. Everybody had thought that she had gone into hiding. Well, I suppose we don't really know what happened before Satine became the Duchess of Mandalore, because there was discussions between her and Obi-Wan about how they were running and hiding when they knew each other before. I was wondering if that would really be in her character.
Since it may not be necessarily in her character so much as it would be in character with the way they want to portray her. Once she's out of the picture, they can pretty much portray her pretty much however they want. It's the issue of a current regime turning around and bashing a former regime that you see all around the world in regimes of all types. It's sort of that build up your own legitimacy by tearing down whatever it was from before and find a weakness of some kind, in this case, the pacifism, if they look at it as a weakness.
So then, after Vizsla is in the role of prime minister and he's happy, Maul comes to him and says, now we're going to expand our influence over other neutral worlds. And Vizsla kind of sits back and goes, no, I kind of like how things are. That may have been your plan, but it's never been mine. And takes Maul prisoner and presents him to the crowd as the mastermind behind these whole plots. And then jails him, throws him in with Savage. Well, that wasn't a good choice. Don't put the two together.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. The audience needed to hear what they're up to, and I guess in theory they needed to just chat it out loud, although it seemed like Darth Maul had this thing all figured out. And you know, they're chatting, they're going back and forth, and the Maul's like, all right, time to go. And what Savage Opress does was freaking cool. And it's one of those things where, you know, when they took Maul prisoner, and even later when we see Maul fighting Vizsla, you kind of think, man, just like we've said about the Jedi so often in this series, how come they're not using all their bad dude type Jedi forces and powers to get out of this and get out of that? And geez, shouldn't two Dark Lords of the Sith or whatever just be able to bust their way out of prison? They're just in there chatting because they chose to.
And I love how Maul was so nonchalant about, I think I want to take a tour. And then, as you said, Savage just kind of busts out of there, and that was impressive.
But wasn't that part of the plan to begin with, though? It sounds like you guys are saying that the betrayal is that Vizsla says, you know, now we're going to do it my way instead of your way, so I'm locking you up. The whole point at first was the, you will then arrest us. I never got any sense that there was ever supposed to be anything but having Maul and Savage wind up being put into the prison cells along with Black Sun and the Pike Syndicate and such until they just were released or broke themselves out as per part of the plan. At what point was there any indication that Maul and Savage somehow, as being part of these groups and part of the groups that are supposed to be being arrested, are somehow going to be left running free, not even with the pretense of being locked up, supposedly, for a little bit? I mean, why should Maul and Savage have been worried when they were locked up? Not only could they bust out, it's all going as I have foreseen kind of stuff, isn't it?
I have to agree with Nathan. Dun, 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 dun. Because they talk about getting somebody else to go along with their plan anyway. They know that Pre Vizsla is going to turn on them, and they're going to need a face. Maul says at the beginning, we need him. He has to be the face. So I think it was part of their plan to get arrested. He kind of gave up a little bit too easy. I mean, he started putting his hands behind his back and stuff like that, took his lightsaber. So I have to agree with Nathan. I think it was part of the plan, but just in a different way. I think that they did surprise him. Pre Vizsla did surprise him when they arrested him at that moment. I don't think that it was pre-planned. He was supposed to walk in at that time and get arrested.
The thing was, when Pre Vizsla was presenting Savage Opress and the Black Sun Leader and the Pike, that was part of the plan. That was, hey, we got these guys, we arrested them. That part was the shoot that Pre Vizsla brought into it. And I don't think Darth Maul was just going along with anything at that point. There was no reason for them to physically be in the jail cell.
I'm going along with Jerry on this. I think they were both on the same plan up to the point where Savage is captured, arrested, what have you. But the minute that Vizsla decides to take Maul prisoner, I don't think that was in the original plan. I don't think Maul ever perceived that. And when he's put in jail, I think Maul kind of sits back and goes, okay, well, how can I use this to my advantage? And he says, well, we know that the other people that would oppose Vizsla should be here. Those are the people we need to talk to because he hasn't solidified his leadership. And then they go and there's a discussion between Maul and Satine. You really get the sense that Maul is not just the animal that he was previously portrayed as. He's a thinker. He's a manipulator. And, you know, he really did learn at the feet of Sidious and knows how to turn situations that may stray from what he wants back to putting him in control.
Maul has a couple great lines here. When he first meets Satine, he says to her, "You're the former Duchess Satine, are you not?" And gets her talking immediately. And she obviously thinks he's a monster. You know, they call them monsters all the time. Mandalore is quite Aryan, as we have talked about before. So they do look quite strange. And when Maul's talking to Satine, she inadvertently gives Maul the name of Almic. And Maul has another great quote where he says, "Thank you for your cooperation." And I thought that was great. You know, he's thanking her.
Now, the other thing that is revealed in this conversation between Maul and Satine is that all her advisors have been executed. That kind of surprised me.
That's two things that she says that surprised. One, that all the leaders have either joined Pre Vizsla or been executed. So we know that there's many Bothans died to bring us this information kind of thing. And then she says that Almic is responsible for killing children. And if you remember that or not from the Kool-Aid, I don't remember if they actually explicitly said that. I remember some children got sick.
I didn't go back and watch that, but I thought kids were sick. I didn't know that kids had died. I guess I would have to rewatch that episode to be sure.
Well, I guess it kind of answers the question. I mean, it sort of stands to reason if you get a large group of kids that sick on something that maybe some of them just, you know, they're not as strong as others or, you know, maybe have particularly allergy, whatever. You have to think that in any epidemic, a couple victims die. It stands to reason that, yeah, maybe in some cases it went too far.
For Satine this time, did anybody else feel like Satine's dialogue was the only dialogue that didn't really fit in some ways with the episode? I mean, she's speaking in terms of ideals. She's very haughty in terms of the way that she says things, very much like she's giving speeches all the time. Whereas we know she doesn't always speak like that because we've seen her dealing more with Obi-Wan. You know, she can talk like a regular person. When dealing with this crisis, it's all about speechifying, even when she's talking to Maul, it seems like, and when she's talking to Almec in the cells. At some point, you got to figure she's got to get into her head that this really is the kind of crisis that doesn't need speeches. She needs to be able to actually do something. And it just felt like her scripting was a little bit off from the rest of them. The rest of them seemed like they very much fit the circumstances. She seemed like she was sort of off in her own little world. Maybe it's just the shock of what has happened.
I think she recognized the foul scent when she was brought on board. I don't know. It's kind of one of those things where, yeah, she's got that voice like Princess Leia did when she's talking to Tarkin. She has this voice that she uses when she's battling somebody verbally, politically, what have you. But I see what you're saying. There was points in time where I was like, man, Satine, even I don't think you should be running this planet.
It's keeping up appearances, you know, it's keeping up appearances. That's great. That's two original trilogy callbacks in one podcast. That's pretty good. I appreciated the way she talked. "I am the Duchess of Mandalore." You know, if anybody's been to a drunk take, they'll know that no matter how much ruckus you're raising, what you're saying, who you are, who you know, if you're related to the councilman, you know, they're going to keep you there as long as they keep you there. So I thought that was pretty funny that she was putting her rage. But again, this is the type of woman that Obi-Wan Kenobi is attracted to. Someone who's regal, someone who is strong, who's going to stand for her principles of nonviolence. You know, many times Pre Vizsla tried to goad her into attack mode, and she wouldn't do it. She stood to her morals. And those are the strong women that we see in Star Wars, whether it be Princess Leia, Padme. When she was Queen Amidala, she stood to her morals. She wouldn't put her people in danger to Mon Mothma. So it's very Star Warsy, and Satine, I love it. And she is great. This performance by this voice actress, too, I think was one of the best that she's ever done.
But to kind of jump back to the first conversation between Satine and Almec, where have those morals gotten you? She's in jail.
I'm just waiting for the moment where she finally drops the pretense, looks Maul straight in the eye, and says, "My boyfriend's going to come and kick your butt."
Maul pitches his plan to Almec, says that he's going to put Almec in the role of prime minister. And when Almec wants to know how he's going to accomplish that, he states that Pre Vizsla is a soldier. And because he's a soldier, he has honor. And if he challenges him to a one-on-one fight, that he will have to accept. And then Almec brings in, and by Mandalorian custom, if you defeat him, all his warriors will then follow you, which leads us into what has to be one of the most amazing fights in Star Wars. Not just the Clone Wars, but in Star Wars.
With that great introductory challenge vocal work for Maul. I mean, you really get the power from him. And if you check out the featurette, even Filoni says, this is the best fight they've ever done. Then he says, except for next week. Next week will be better. Kind of teasing along the way. But he notes that this had to be one of the best fights in all of Star Wars, because if not, in his words, he'd be mobbed by fans of Pre Vizsla at the next celebration over how he goes out. So he had to go out in a great way. Yeah. I love that he's using everything in his arsenal. What really got me was not a particular weapon. It's the moment where he pulls kind of the dirty fighting thing where he swings the darksaber, cuts the floor, and throws little chips up in Maul's face. I mean, of all the weapons he's got, that's the one that struck me as the most underhanded, because at least the other stuff was part of his armor. That was just like the kicking sand in someone's face.
Well, and Filoni goes as far as, this was really funny. It's kind of a big shot to George to say, yeah, this isn't going to be any Boba Fett in the Sarlacc pit. I thought that was pretty good.
Wow, that's funny. But what a great fight. What a great fight. What a great fight. We have Pre Vizsla, who is bound by honor, you know, and they mention that. It brings everything back. Maul and Savage say that the honor is their weakness when they're still healing up. And now they bring it all the way back to where he's going to use the honor of their warrior culture to challenge into a fight. And I honestly didn't know who was going to win. I mean, I know that Maul is, when Maul got his saber and did his growl, I'm like, you are not going to give Maul his saber. I was like, then you're automatically done. And I loved the, for Mandalore. I mean, it gets you pumped up. These are the type of battles that you want to see. It's something, this battle meant something. You know, it was either going to be Pre Vizsla or was going to be Maul. It was not one of them was going to walk away. I like that. It wasn't going to be one of these, you know, Anakin fighting Grievous fights where you know nothing's going to happen. Some consequences was going to happen. I love this fight.
And one thing I do like about the whole idea that single combat can lead to someone who's not necessarily a Mandalorian by birth to wind up becoming the leader of Mandalore, I like that because it's not something that's necessarily new. We see a lot of different ways that people become Mandalore throughout the Star Wars Expanded Universe, but one of the earliest ones in the early 90s in the modern EU was when Ulic Kheldroma, who was a Jedi who was sort of shifting towards the dark side during the time of the original Sith War, where it's him and Exar Kun going up against the Republic and whatnot, where Ulic tries to go kind of like Luke in Dark Empire. He wants to learn about the dark side from within, and it doesn't go so well. He defeats Mandalore the Indomitable, who apparently was domitable, and gets the title of Mandalore that way and gets the Mandalorian allegiance up to the end of the Sith War. So, you know, just like he's sort of dipping back into some earlier things, I think they're all building off the same sort of cultural traditions in the real world. But we definitely see some ties into previous Mandalorian culture. I think those who have been worried about how are they going to fix this whole pacifist Mandalorian thing in the EU and make it all work, I think they're starting to see that there was a little more planning to this. I was surprised. And a little more ties into what has come before, that maybe we should have given them more credit for how they're going to wind up working this out.
We will have to wait and see. But the way that this fight ends, did anybody else catch, you know, shades of Highlander? There can be only one, with him coming down and decapitating him.
I didn't, but I should have. Especially, golly, with Clancy Brown being, you know, not in the room as obviously as Savage Opress, but I mean, you got that connection with Kurgan. But no, I didn't. That's so cool. I can't believe I missed that.
Maul is everything. He knows everything.
No, seriously, though. And I guess from looking at the materials on StarWars.com, originally he was going to chop his head off and then we were going to see it bounce down the stairs, but they cut that because they thought it was going to be a little too rough for a Saturday morning. Mommy, they just cut off his head and it bounced around the room. You're not watching that show anymore.
Yeah, don't say.
Arms are okay. Legs are okay. Heads, not so much, apparently. So no cutting off of heads and no kissing clones before they die.
Bingo.
So after Maul defeats Vizsla, he steps up to the throne and claims himself the new leader of Death Watch. A lot of the troops just step into line and accept it, but not Bo-Katan. She refuses to accept the idea that an outsider will ever be in charge of Mandalore.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool because that sort of struck me at the same time that I guess in the episode came to Bo-Katan is that, wait a minute, they just all stood and watched a non-Mandalorian take out a Mandalorian, take out Pre Vizsla, right? I mean, so I was kind of surprised that any of them just bow before Darth Maul. I kind of half expected, and I only say half because I sort of knew that people like Pre Vizsla, Satine, Savage Opress, you know, there's no reason why they shouldn't die. So I kind of expect them to die, but at the same time, I kind of expected them to not let Darth Maul finish the battle. But I guess that whole Mandalorian honor thing played out exactly like it needed to and, you know, was done properly. They wouldn't dare interfere. But I thought it was kind of cool that Bo-Katan did that because to me that kind of tells you this whole Mandalorian story, for whatever it's worth, the Death Watch story can, you know, live to be told another day. It just doesn't all end here because what could possibly happen with a true Mandalorian commando warrior culture? Because, you know, Darth Maul is not going to stay long-term ruler of Mandalore. So part of that faction's got to fly off to go fight another day.
And this kind of steps back to something we discussed last week about Mandalorian honor. Who does it affect? Is it global? Their honor affects how they deal with everyone, or their honor affects how they deal with just Mandalorians? And I think we get our answer here. For some Mandalorians, honor means everybody. And if Maul followed by the laws or the traditions of Mandalore, and he defeated Pre Vizsla, that they're going to follow him. But Bo-Katan, who was very devoted to Vizsla, says that she is not, that it doesn't apply to him.
Her whole thing, though, Filoni plays that as sort of patriotism, that for her it's more about what's good for Mandalore, not about necessarily her specific faction. It's not Death Watch that she's worried about Maul being the leader of, it's Mandalore as a whole. I think that sort of plays into this idea that, you know, she is more of an honorable character, perhaps in the classic sense, than perhaps even the other Mandalorians tend to be. I would argue this is why she was introduced back in A Friend in Need. You know, they said we'd see more of her, why they got Katie Sackhoff to play the character for that couple of lines back in A Friend in Need. It's for this. She gets to be now a major factor in, of course, this episode and this arc, but now in next week's episode, because, you know, there's no way that she's just going to run off with her people and disappear. Now that we're going to see the fight for Mandalore as we move on into next week, she's going to have to be a major factor. It's just a question of how many times she'll be able to come back afterwards. As Jerry said, you know, if she's able to fight another day, will we get to see her fight another day? Or is this essentially the end cap of this Mandalorian arc that we've been seeing growing since, what, season 2 back in the day? I like the fact, though, that they at least seeded the actress in that minor role as Bo-Katan, knowing she'd be coming back here. It could have been very easy to just get somebody who was a regular on the show to do a couple of lines and forget it, or switch voice actors midway along the way, going from the bit part and the one that had a little more oomph to it. And kudos to Katie Sackhoff for taking the role when, at least to start with, there wasn't much to it.
The episode kind of wraps up with Almec speaking to the crowd and stating that Satine has assassinated or killed Vizsla, but now she's in custody.
And how exactly did she kill Pre Vizsla? Yeah, she beat him in a fist fight. Who's believing that?
She hit a bomb underneath the throne whenever she ran away.
It stretches believability even in-universe, but I think the people at that point want to believe it because they seem to accept the idea of their warrior heritage quite quickly. I think a lot of them kind of glommed onto it. And I don't know if you guys noticed when they were showing shots of the crowd, there were some of them just in regular civilian garb that was very reminiscent of Mandalorian armor. There were certain tunics and things that people were wearing that had the same sort of pattern on them that breastplates on the Mandalorian armor did. I thought that was an interesting cue, but it does lend to the fact that they aren't all happy little pacifists. But in any case, Almec basically calls out the fact that he wasn't always on the up and up. I forget exactly what he says, but he apologizes for things that he's done in the past and promises that the good of Mandalore is really what he is going to make his priority.
And I think that was the key phrase right there. Because right there, we're getting where his character is going to go. The good of his people is what's important to him. He's going to bow down to Maul until he gets a chance to defeat Maul or do whatever he has to do for the people. So right there, that was very important. We now know where his heart lies.
He's very much sort of a modern politician, right? Satine was the idealistic politician, the idealized politician. He's willing to put principle over just about anything else, praying that that will somehow save the day for her people, and up to certain points, it has. It has worked out sometimes. And Almec is much more of a, he's going to do what is the honorable thing as much as he can, but when it comes to doing some, getting his hands dirty, he's willing to do so. I mean, he even states in this episode about how Satine's regime was propped up in part because of the things that he was able to bring in through the black market. By him breaking that law and getting his hands dirty, he managed to make sure that the system stayed stable and her regime stayed in power. So it sort of seems as though, I don't know, I mean, he's willing to get his hands dirty. I think my question is, how much is he willing to get his hands dirty? At this point, he's willing to go along with Maul of all people. So maybe this is him thinking this could be a lot worse if it was someone else who was in charge. Maybe I can moderate what it is that Maul wants done, perhaps by being his mouthpiece, et cetera, when he leaves. Maybe I can lead them in a good way. But at the same time, he is allying himself with a Sith Lord in order to do this, or a wannabe Sith Lord, whatever you want to think of him as, in order to do this. I'm wondering whether Almec is going to be played out, as Barrett was saying there, as sort of a character who is about the good of his people, and he's going to be sort of a flawed hero going forward? Or is Almec going to essentially be the way that Satine looked at him, which is sort of a, you're corrupt an inch, you know, you're corrupt a mile, and he's going to wind up being someone who winds up playing out as more of a villain because he's willing to go along with perhaps, you know, atrocities or who knows what it is that, you know, the Knight Brothers are going to try to pull here on the populace if they were to get out of hand. I don't know if we're going to see that, but if we did, you know, there's that question of which direction he's going to turn. I think the judgment on whether Almec is a good guy or a bad guy, whether he's as honorable as he says he is still kind of out. But that's pretty much a modern political mindset to be in.
Well, it certainly opens the door to go either way, which, again, lends to the good writing of this episode. So if you could actually be fans with him, it definitely opens the door for him to work with the Jedi if he feels it's going to help with his people. So it'll be interesting to see.
And I can't wait to see it. Now, we all really love this episode, but let's listen to some voicemails and see if everybody felt this way.
Hi, Republic Force Radio Network. It's Robert Arthur Curry calling with my thoughts on Shades of Reason. Wow. I think this may have reached my, it's definitely in my top five episodes of the entire show. It'd be tough to knock out my top two or three, but I think it's really close. I mean, I was a little worried about the beginning of the episode. The whole, you know, ruse coming in, swooping in to save the day for Death Watch with the, you know, stopping the criminal organization seemed a little cliche, a little almost, for lack of a better way of putting it, comical. I mean, I know it wasn't funny, but it just seemed, yeah, we've seen that particular plot device used before, but you know, it was an effective way to get, you know, Death Watch in good graces with the people. It's nice to see some new character models for some familiar people. You know, Satine's got a new look again, which is kind of nice. But obviously when we moved into our second part of the episode, the in between the first commercial break and the second commercial break is when it really started picking up. I think we've seen the first instance of what I will now coin as Chekhov's prime minister. If you put a prime minister on the wall in the third season, you might as well bring him down off the wall and use him in the fifth season. I was actually very surprised to see Almec again. And I love the way that they used him. It was a very effective way of bringing back a rather unremarkable or unlikable character. The one thing that I kind of thought about, and now I'm actually going to have to go back to watch the Tainted Kool-Aid episodes, is I didn't remember them mentioning that children actually died from the poisoning. I mean, I knew they mentioned that some were getting sick, but, you know, that may have, that's kind of ramped up the whole corruption arc to having much more importance in the grand scheme of things. Like I said, you know, it's nice the way that sometimes it's a little drop line here or there, a little piece of a later episode that helps make an earlier one actually at least a little bit better. Of course, now I've listened to Corruption said about a million times. But getting back to today's episode, the duel between Vizsla and Maul was just amazing. Everything you could have wanted to have seen. I mean, it was nice. It was long, well choreographed, great camera angles. And throughout the whole arc so far, the music has really been on point. I've absolutely loved the score this time around, and I'm really hoping that we continue to see this level of, you know, a little less of the synthesized, you know, MIDI-sounding stuff like we saw in the earlier seasons, and far more orchestral as we're moving along. That's basically most of what I have for this one. I mean, I'm definitely going to have to get a chance to watch this one probably 3, 4, 5 more times. It's nice to see the Darksaber in the hands of the Sith, or at least the Sith wannabe, depending on how you look at Maul. It's going to be hard for them to wrap this entire thing up in one episode. I really wish we were going to see more than this, but who knows? You know, this can continue on in the following season. But I'm eagerly waiting to see what happens next week, and definitely looking forward to hearing your thoughts. Have a great one, everybody. Talk to you later. Bye.
Darth Akari, thank you very much for calling in. And I think you may have won the award for most agreeable voicemail we've ever got. I think you've hit a major point in your voicemail that we've all kind of discussed, from the way that Darth Maul and Death Watch were able to infiltrate Mandalore and get the Mandalorians on their side, to the reintroduction of Malak and how it is told that he killed some kids now, which makes him a murderer. Before, maybe he was just kind of a corrupt politician before, but now he's a murderer of children. So that puts that on him, to the fact that this amazing battle that happens between Maul and Pre Vizsla. You know, one thing you did mention that we didn't talk about was Dutch Satine's new look. She does have a new look, and it's kind of a less flary look, because when we were first introduced to her, she kind of had those bugles, I think those were called. I don't know if those are part of her hair, but they were kind of bugles that kind of looked like fanned out. And now her hair is kind of pulled back. It looks more regal, more Padme-ish, more Mon Mothma-type look. And I liked her look. What did you guys think about her look?
Probably not just stylish to wear the same hairstyle that they have of the big stained glass-looking window thing behind you of your head. That'd probably be a little tacky. It was cool to see them fighting in front of it, though. I think it was Maul who was standing in front of it for a bit.
All right. Now, let's see what our next listener had to say.
Hey, RFRN, this is Ben, or Davis on the forums, as always. And when I woke up this morning, I couldn't get out of bed fast enough, because I could not wait to see how things would unfold with this morning's episode of The Clone Wars. You guys know how much I praised Eminence last week. Well, Shades of Reason is even better. You could almost say that it stands a head above the last episode. Bad jokes aside, we've seen some good fight scenes before. I mean, go back and rewatch the hallway sequence, if you could call that thing a hallway, with Vizsla last episode. But the duel between Maul and Vizsla is the best fight scene we've seen thus far. Now, I say thus far, obviously, because of what we have yet to see with next week's episode of The Lawless. In short, Maul, Sidious, and Savage. I'm sure I speak for more than just myself when I say that I expect big, big things from the next episode. But among the many other things that I loved about Shades of Reason, the visuals just, they do not fail to impress. I mean, when Savage shattered the cell that he and Maul were in, just how he hunched over and physically shook, that was nothing short of incredible. I mean, I really love how they've been using Savage these past couple of episodes. Yes, he is the blunt instrument, but he is powerful. And also, Nathan, maybe you can shed some light on this if you haven't already. I guess losing almost an entire arm doesn't affect you using that arm later to call on the Force? Yes? No? Maybe? No. Anyway, Another great scene visually was Bo-Katan's escape. When she leapt from that balcony and the explosives went off behind her, that was just impressive. I love it. I loved it. And, this arc has marked a lot of first occasions for me. I mean, with the music and just the storyline and what they did with Vizsla, I was just starting to like him. He was just starting to be cool. But I cannot wait for next Saturday. I mean, just to see how everything will be tied up. Will there be a Death Watch by the end of next week? Will Bo-Katan survive? Will she lead Death Watch now? And what will happen to Satine? Will the former Duchess survive this arc, or will she die as well? And what will happen to Mandalore itself? Will this arc bring us to the point that many EU fans wanted Mandalore to start out as way back in season one, was it? I don't know, but I really wish it was Saturday again, because, oh my gosh, I cannot wait to see this. Filoni himself said that playtime is over, and we have seen that in spades. Now, I'm not sure what's going to happen, I mean, with the next two arcs, but that's not important. But without any further ado, I think I'm going to go rewatch Eminence and Shades of Reason. Thanks, guys.
You know, we talked about that whole issue with the arms and stuff a little bit last week. It seems as though I think the consensus tended to be that you don't necessarily need to focus the force through that arm. It's just that's used as sort of a way to focus the way you're thinking to be able to adapt and use the force and whatnot. So it seems as though it's not a huge hindrance, although the more of your body that's gone, in theory, the more it harms your connection, at least the way that Lucas has talked about Vader before. I, too, like the whole Savage, you know, bending down, the and then the big blast outward. We saw that sort of with the Repulse-type move back in his first story arc, back whenever he was first created. But here, I thought it was kind of neat that we have Sam Witwer's character sitting right next to a character who pulls a The Force Unleashed move, which was that whole Force Repulse, the drawing in the Force energy and then blasting out. But as for what to expect for next week, I'm again looking back at that Who Will Fall image and the fact they have 10 characters listed. This season is now down two of those. In fact, both of them being in this arc, if you count Revival as part of the arc. Again, I don't want to spoil anything having gone through Shadow Conspiracy, but suffice to say, we ain't seen nothing yet. If you're excited already, be excited some more.
I think the series, particularly with these characters, have done an excellent job of creating characters brand new to the series. That, you know, Pre-Vizsla is a perfect example. He's been with us for four seasons now. This one being the fourth when he, you know, starts in season two. So you follow his story. We're not with him very often. We don't see him a lot. But just time-wise, we first became introduced to Death Watch in 2010. So, or maybe early 2009. I forget which, you know, part of the season it was in. So to see a character like him die does mean something. So it's like in season one when we saw Nadar Veb, who was Kit Fisto's Padawan, just turned Jedi Knight. We're introduced to him, and he dies by General Grievous's lightsabers all within one episode. We're like, who cares? We don't know this guy. Maybe if you like Mon Calamari in general, then you kind of enjoyed seeing that species, but you weren't really connected with this character. Pre Vizsla, we got connected with. Even someone like Steela, even though we, you know, she was contained to a single arc, she was used so well that by the time we got to the fourth episode and she died, we were like, oh no, they killed Steela. So kudos to the show of creating that. I think you have other characters like that. Savage Opress is in there. Heck, even Darth Maul now. His character, for the most part, is created by this show, not the Phantom Menace anymore. So there's a lot of characters on the line now that we could be concerned about. Ahsoka being probably the main one now that we're really attached to, obviously with five seasons in a movie. Even if you don't like her, you're used to her. Good job. The show is having some impact on characters that we've come to love.
Hey, Republic Forces Radio Network, this is Zach, and I'm here to talk with you about Shades of Reason. And holy cow, this was an awesome episode. I absolutely loved this episode. Something that I've wanted to see since season two was the invasion of Mandalore, or a battle on Mandalore, whatever you want to call it. But wow, this was an amazing episode. And also, I'm not sure if this was exactly the episode you want to show to your kids, because there were points where even civilians were getting killed by Black Sun and whatever that other species is called. I can't remember the name of them. But, yeah, it was pretty brutal and stuff. And, man, I just tell you what, I just love that they brought back Maul into this series. I mean, you know, back when Phantom Menace came out and we heard that Darth Maul was going to be in those movies, I thought that he was going to be like the Darth Vader of the prequels. You know, he would be the, you know, the main, not really the main bad guy besides the Emperor, but, you know, he was going to be like the Darth Vader of the prequels. Now, that didn't turn, it didn't turn out that way. That's okay. And they brought him back here, and here they have a great opportunity for that. Of course, we know he's probably going to bite the bucket, you know, sometime before the series is over because, well, we do know that he doesn't make it to Revenge of the Sith and all. But, and, man, I just love the Mandalorians going around and, you know, like capturing all the Black Sun and whatever that other species is. It was just so awesome. And I cannot wait for next episode. And, you know, I know Pre Vizsla died in this episode and stuff. And I think next week is just going to be the last bloody slaughter or whatever, because I think that it's all going to go to hell next week. I mean, anybody short of Obi-Wan, who we know is coming in next week, and Sidious, who I think is coming in next week, because I think this is the last episode, the Lawless or whatever it's called. I think that's the last episode of this arc, but I could be wrong. I'm going to predict it right now. I think three major characters are going to die. Satine is probably going to die, I bet. Darth Maul and Savage Opress, I bet, might die. Maybe not Darth Maul. I'm betting, though, Savage Opress will die. I could be wrong, but, you know, the fact that Sidious is coming in and he's going to fight those two, you know, someone's not going to walk away from that, and it's not going to be Sidious, so it's got to be one of those two. And I know you guys had a problem with Maul, you know, not being able to kill that one bounty hunter last week. I can't remember her name right now. But, you know, and he was having a hard time with Pre Vizsla this week and all that. But, you know, Pre Vizsla is a Mandalorian warrior, so I kind of gave it to them, because in the EU, Mandalorian warriors are known for being able to take on Jedi and stuff. And, well, yes, Pre Vizsla did lose and, well, kind of lost his cranium, but that's... He went out pretty bad. He had a good out, unlike, say, Boba Fett in Episode 6, which I know he returns in the EU, but whatever. But, yeah, cannot wait for next week. This is the best episode today, but I think next episode is probably going to be, like, the best episode of the series. I just, man, this small arc has turned out so well. All right, I'll call in about next week about the Lawless.
Zach, I really can't agree with you more about Maul in this series. If you go back and listen to the way we ended last season, I said, I believe I said anyway, that when they announced that Darth Maul was coming back into the Star Wars universe as Clone Wars, I was very, very skeptical. I wasn't sure how that was going to work out. I felt like it was going to be kind of like a cut and paste, but I'm happy to say that I think I was wrong. Even though maybe his introduction originally left a little bit of question in my mind, the way they're using him is just phenomenal. And I think he really is a lot of what this series needed to inject some life and some action and some real drama into it. So kudos to them for bringing him in. And I kind of hope that they don't kill him off next week, because I think that used properly, this could be just a tremendous character for as long as they want to keep this series going.
Hey there, this is Alan Bithsith from the forums calling in with my thoughts on this week's episode of The Clone Wars. I loved it. Going to go watch it again and again. Thought it was a great action episode. Did feel like a little bit of setup, but we know that there's another episode coming. Just a couple of thoughts. One, I thought it was great that Darth Maul came up with a Phantom Menace of his own. He's definitely following in his master's footsteps. Something seemed a little too obvious, how quickly the Mandalorian people flipped over to following the Death Watch, but it seems like they're just trying to get into the time frame. The other thing I noticed was the sort of the artistic representation of the episode. If you look all over the place in the buildings, in the clothing, even in the hair of Almec, for instance, you can see patterns of the original Mandalorian armor from Boba Fett. And I thought that was kind of fun that they just incorporated that motif into everything. One thing I did notice in the close-up scene where Satine and Almec were talking in jail was that they looked a little funky, and even my 8-year-old daughter said that his hands looked like they were made out of Lego. So I thought that was kind of interesting. You get that close-up, you really see kind of that really old Clone Wars series wouldn't look to some of the characters. But otherwise, great episode. Can't wait for next week. Can't wait to hear what you guys think.
Okay, we'd like to thank everybody for calling in, and we look forward to hearing what you guys think of next week's episode, Lawless. Now, Jerry, Nathan, Barrett, do you guys have any predictions for what we're going to see? Well, actually, Nathan, I don't want to hear what you have to say because you know.
I'm going to agree with the last caller. I think Savage is going to get it. I think Darth Maul is going to get it. And probably Satine's going to get it. I think that Darth Sidious is just going to come in at the end and he's just going to take care of business. And that's how they're going to wrap it up. You know, if you decapitate the leadership, then what do you have left? You'll have Almec to pick up the pieces of Mandalore.
You know, overall, I would find it very difficult to argue against any statement that says that this could have been the best episode of the series. It's kind of like the episode we had last season where you had Boba Fett leading the band of bounty hunters and Asajj Ventress joined up with him a little bit. And I made the statement slash joke that said, wow, I don't know what show I watch because it certainly wasn't the Clone Wars. I watched the premiere episode of this new show called Star Wars Bounty Hunters, and I can't wait to see what happens. I feel like this arc so far has been the Star Wars Sith Lords, or the Maulio brothers, as I like to call them. The Maul brothers, and just like, you know, these guys could be a standalone series. I mean, the work they've done with Maul and Savage Opress have been excellent, and it just keeps getting better. And I can't help but to think how little Season 5 has given us of Anakin and Obi-Wan, and even Ahsoka to a lesser degree. Obviously, she was involved in the Onderon arc, but this has been an entire season of not having the A players, not having the, let's call it, the movie cast of characters. And Gascon and D-Squad aside, not half bad. Granted, we're 5 years into it, and they're just kind of now getting to that point where they can get away with that, but pretty impressive. Maul and Savage Opress could really carry their own storylines, and it's been fantastic.
Now, like you guys, I am very much looking forward to the fight between Maul, Savage, and Sidious next week. But I'm also looking forward to the confrontation between Sidious and Maul, because I'm thinking, and it is the psychologist in me coming out, but essentially Maul was abandoned by Sidious. And I'm thinking he's got some pretty strong feelings about that, and I'll be hopeful and curious to see if they address any of that next week when Maul and Sidious come face to face for the first time in so many years.
Well, if you can call being chopped in half down to shaft abandoned, yeah. But you know, a friend on the forums brought up a good point. He said that Maul and Savage still have a link to Mother Talzin. And that was proven when Savage got his arm chopped off and Maul's legs, you know, they still had that green smoke. So I wonder if she will show up or have some sort of presence in the last episode.
So it'll be a tearjerker, Maul finally finding his surrogate mother and surrogate father showing up so that they can then do the classic sitcom thing and try to find a way to put them together by putting himself in crisis. Come together for the good of the child.
Well, I don't know if they will wrap everything up, if they could kill Maul and Savage without wrapping up the Mother Talzin link. So maybe they won't die, who knows, but it's going to be interesting.
All right, guys, well, I want to thank you for the discussion tonight. It's been very enjoyable, and I look forward to seeing next week's episode and hearing what you guys think of that. Have a good night, everyone.
See you, Jonathan.
See you, guys.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Jerry, Jonathan, Nathan, and Barrett. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all of the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademark Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production. Copyright 2013, all rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I agree. We definitely need less circumcised music.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, no. No, he said synthesized. Never mind. Delete that. Delete that.
Oh, no,
that.
We're going to use that, bud. I don't want to hear what you have to say, because you know.
But it leaves out my joke. I want to see Sidious come in and fight the brothers, and I want to see him turn to Maul, who was, of course, played by Ray Park, and ask, "You know what happens when you strike a Sith Lord with lightning? The same thing that happens to everything else."
You want my prediction for the fight? Pain. Come on, Rocky.
Oh my
God,
this is not now playing, guys. Cut it out.
See you guys. Everything is... never mind. See you guys.